Accession number 28699, Reel 10.
Mr. Casey, Reel 10. You were on the island, Mr. Casey. What were the conditions under which you were operating?
Well, it was extremely cold. I don't know, minus 20 or something. It was terrifically cold. And in the daytime, it was okay because we could see for miles, you see. And I had a little house there that I kept fires burning in, and anybody could come in. But at night, we were in the slit trenches, and it was bitterly cold. In fact, pal of mine, Alan Capstaker, was 6 feet four. I remember him coming in once to warm his feet, and he was crying with his feet, I don't know if he had frostbite or what. But it was bitter. And the Germans operated at night. They did send patrols in, so we had to be there. We had to be in the slit trenches. And I think that's where I realised the difference with the troops, British and German. Usually a patrol, well, always I think a patrol was an officer and some men. Maybe a fighting patrol might have 12 men, or it might be just 5 men. But the Germans did it without officers. The NCOs did it. Which, you know, showed, I think, that the discipline was more strict in the German army. Maybe they shot them if they didn't go, I don't know, but that was one thing that surprised me. When we did catch anybody or shoot anybody, but that was really the main thing. In the daytime, it was great, and we met the local people, the Dutch people, who were magnificent to us. They just loved the British troops. We were in their houses in the day, but at night it was bitter.
Did you take any patrols out yourself?
Not there, no. No, we... See, I suppose there was nobody for us to find unless we went across the river. I told you about the Americans doing it. Not, I don't know if it was exactly there, but it probably was there, yes. But we never did.
In the November, news came through they were breaking up 50 div.
Yes.
At that time, and 8th and 6th were going out, and you were going over into an armoured role.
Yes.
Armoured infantry role.
We were
the recall that time?
7th Armoured Div, yes. The main thing I recall is that John Morg, the colonel, said, right, now we've got our pick of the 6th and the 8th if we want to change any of our troops. So he sent back the fellow who'd been carrier platoon commander, a fellow called Gardner, who used to do the admin role and let me do the patrolling. Anyway, the colonel had obviously got onto this, and he sent him back and told me I was going to be the platoon commander. But I couldn't be a captain because I had too many, so I had to stay as a lieutenant. And I said, well, in that case, I want to pick my platoon sergeant because the one I've got now, I don't want him. So he went back, and I got somebody else. But I said to the other sergeants,
he was younger than. And you
that's right. Yes. Well, that. That's right, yes. So that's what happened there.
Do you recall the disappointment that a division that had gone so long, and of course your sister battalions had been with you so long, suddenly gone?
No, it didn't. It's strange, but you weren't that close. I mean, you were in your own battalion, your own company. The other battalions were vaguely close, but I mean, you didn't see them much. You were so occupied with your own platoon in your own company in your own battalion. So it didn't really bother us. And the idea that we were going to the 7th Armoured Div, which was a great division, it meant we were going to be more mobile and probably not having to walk so far. And then we with me being the carrier platoon commander, I fitted in very well, you know, that because although we were only carriers, not tanks, we were mobile and we were on tracks.
Presumably your role didn't change a great deal then when you went into an armoured division?
No, no. My role, in fact, became more to do because we were moving faster. And so my carrier platoon were doing more patrolling and leading the battalion wherever we were going. So it was a better role, really, for the carriers.
And you're getting into winter this time. How was that affecting you?
Well, it was... when we had to stop somewhere, it was very cold. And keeping warm was the main object. I think I told you about when we were all pinned down and there was shelling and I kept this fire going and it was in another place, but it was the same sort of thing. So whenever we stopped, we tried to find somewhere that the men could come in every so often, every hour or so on. And brewing up and making tea, it was all to do with keeping warm as much as anything.
You mean now training, obviously, and getting experience of working closely with tanks?
Well, we didn't work all that close with them. I mean, they tended to go ahead and we'd catch up. And we didn't really do any attacking with lots of tanks with us. It seemed to change very little the role, except that we moved further and faster because tanks were clearing the way, although I told you about one thing where we had to go along this road and the Tiger tanks came and blew up the carriers. Well, that was when we were with the 7th Armoured and they were 10 miles ahead, the tanks.
What were the infantry being carried in? What were the vehicles?
Well, mostly lorries, trucks, you know, and that's all really, trucks and different vehicles of that kind, but not armoured vehicles of any kind, just ordinary trucks, which is why I tended to be leading the battalion a lot. Apart from the thing of map reading and so on, that we were more fluid and we were more protected, although it wasn't that much protection, but at least it's the carriers stopped a rifle. But the role didn't change very much, except it happened quicker. That's really the main thing, that we moved on faster.
Do you recall any events in which you got involved early at this stage? I mean, this time you're still in Belgium, Holland at this moment in time. There was an operation, I think, called Operation Black Truck, when there was some fighting involved with your battalion and tank support or whatever it was.
Yes. I don't instantly remember particular things. I mean, it was a continuous thing that we kept going on. Then we'd be stopped, and then we'd clear a village or clear houses, and then we'd go on. And I mean, often the tanks would just go through, and we'd arrive, and there were Germans still in the houses and things, so we had to do the infantry role of house clearing.
Did you get involved in house clearing with your carriers at all? I mean, obviously, carriers didn't drive into houses.
No. Only when. If there was some operation where we couldn't go, like across a river or something that hadn't been bridged, and then I'd have to take my men as infantry. But house clearing was not a frequent thing for us, for the platoon. Ours is more swanning round up the roads and tracks. And
a spearhead kind of
thing. Yeah, yeah.
It's presumably that you were in a situation then where you could have been the first ones fired at.
Oh, yes, we were, sometimes, yes. Oh, yes, that happened. And then we'd sight things, you know. We'd be going along and suddenly we'd see some German troops or vehicles, and then we'd whip back fast to tell the colonel, you know, that we have to mount an attack of some kind. But we often saw things first. We didn't then go in and attack it on our own. I mean, we tended to be given a job like on the flanks or something to tackle that part of it, or hold defensive positions on the flank of the battalion. I don't know whether I told you about one village we had when we were on the outskirts, and two Americans came from headquarters. Well, it was very funny because, well, it was dangerous and funny. The thing was, we were on the outskirts of this battalion, and we had to occupy this little village. Well, it wasn't that little, there was 80 odd houses. And I had my carrier platoon, which was no way that we could cope with all this, but we had to. So I put the sections out as well as I could. I occupied a little bungalow thing, a little cottage thing, as a headquarters. And I was there with my sergeant and my headquarters staff. And I couldn't get any mines. I asked for mines, couldn't get any mines. They said I could have trip flares, two. They gave me two trip flares. Well, I spent as much time sighting these two as Monty probably spent at Alamein. And I was thrilled a bit because the second night, one of them went up, which meant the German patrol had actually caught where I'd put my flare. And I was able to call down artillery on the area in front, but no mines, no, and nothing like adequate number of men. Anyway, after about three or four nights, I had one man outside as an outside sentry, and at the first light he'd shout, "Stand to," saying everybody would get up. Now, the first part of the night, I was on duty, second part, sergeant, but he was in the back of this little cottage. And this lad who was outside, instead of shouting when the dawn was coming, he walked in and put the kettle on, and he was followed in by a German. I didn't know at the time, but obviously a German patrol had come through, and this German followed him in and wanted to take him prisoner. And this lad dived through the door into the room where I was sleeping, lying on top of my bed. And he put five bullets in this lad. Amazingly, none of them was vital, and he was back about 3 months later. But anyway, he put five bullets in, he fell across my little cot bed, and I woke, and I could see this German about 2 feet away, silhouetted behind this Tommy gun, you know, the Schmeisser, I think is they were. And it went through my mind like a flash. I thought, well, the first time I move, he sees me and I'm dead. So the first move has got to be important. And I leapt out of the bed, I'm sure without touching anything, and round a little alcove and stood there. And it was only a few seconds, I suppose, but it seemed a long time. And I remember vividly thinking, I hope he doesn't shoot me in the stomach because it's going to hurt. And after, 30 seconds, nothing had happened. So I came out and grabbed my revolver, which was there, ran outside, and I saw this patrol disappearing in the distance. When I came back in, the sergeant had come rushing in. "What's going on?" I said, "What's going on? The bloody German army's been here, and you were asleep." He said, "No, I wasn't." And this lad is lying across the bed, you see, bleeding. So he said, "Well," I said, "oh, he's shot him. He doesn't seem to, he's not dead." But and I was furious. I said, "A silly soldier came into my room." Anyway, so I got to headquarters and tell him what's happened.
Did you call his name, the young soldier?
No. And the sergeant said, "You've been hit." I said, "What the hell are you talking about?" He said, "Look, and there was blood pouring all down my shirt, you see. And apparently, these fire in this fusillade of bullets, one had caught me across the upper lip, and one had caught my fingertip. And didn't do any real damage, but I was pouring with blood, you see. So he said, right, I get the Jeep. And he got one of the lads, he said, take Mr. Casey down to headquarters, see the doc. So I thought, well, I might get a night off, you know, with a bit of luck. Anyway, I got back. The doctor put some penicillin ointment on it and a bandage on my finger and a sticky thing across my lip, and he gave me a cup of hot sweet tea. And he said, well, you'll be wanting to get back to your lads now. I said, oh, yes, of course. And I drove back. And the sergeant said, what the hell are you? I said, this silly so-and-so sent me back. Anyway, the colonel then, well, a couple of days later, sent a company to take this over. And the company commander said to me, I'd like you to stay with... I said, you've got to be joking. We've had this for about 6 days on our own. You will accompany me. You're on your own. We're going and have a rest. But a funny thing happened about the third day. Because, as I said, we just had a flare go up, and that was all. And suddenly... But the lads used to go into the village next to this little place. And the funny thing was, every time they went in, the Germans were still there. It was a German village. They used to hang the sheets out the window to surrender again, see. And our lads were going and buying eggs and milk and stuff. Anyway, these two Americans arrived from headquarters, both with middle-aged spread, and he said, Sergeant and I tried very hard not to laugh out loud. He said, we've been sent from headquarters, we've got to get into that village. I said, yeah, well, that's all right. I said, Harrison, have you been in this morning? He said, yes, sir, I got the egg and milk, the milk and eggs, he said. I said, oh, well, he said, well, we'll need an escort. I said, yes, sure, Sergeant. Diggs Hill, half a dozen men to take these fellas in. And then one of them turned to the other and said, now listen, Jake, you ain't going, you're a married man. See, well, we were trying, turning away not to laugh, you know. And then he came out, the other fellow came out with this classic John Wayne. He must have seen every John Wayne picture, because he said, okay, but if you ain't back in 10 minutes, I'm coming a shooting. And at that point, I had to bury my head in something. Anyway, they went off and they came back, and it was like this fellow had done the invasion on his own. The other fellow greeting him, you know. And then they asked us, could they buy any German guns? So the lads were flogging them revolvers at exorbitant prices. And they disappeared.
They were great souvenir hunters, I think, the Americans.
Oh, yes, yes. But it was, I'm coming a shooting. I thought, oh, my God. Anyway, like, of course, 2 nights later, they did come. But in the daytime, you could see literally for miles. There was nothing. And then we were pulled out, as I say.
During the winter, did you get into white clothing?
Oh, yes. Well, sometimes. But the troops often did, the infantry platoons often did. And I did one thing, I don't know whether I told you this. John Mogg had said to me, the carriers can't go across because there's no bridge. And he was wearing a white tracksuit, a tank suit, white tank suit.
I think you told me this one,
I told you,
yeah. And, you had that,
and he made me wear a...
He made you put the...
Well, that was
the smock on, yeah.
Same time, you see. And...
Were the German fighting every inch of the way, or did they go a distance and then start try to hold you again?
Well, by that time, they were moving back quite rapidly, and then you'd run into another lot, you know, stand. They'd put up a stand. But it wasn't like Picage, where it was every few yards. This time it was maybe 2 or 3 miles, you know.
What about booby traps and mines? Were they a problem?
Not as much then. There had been much more in Normandy and Picage. But now, it occasionally happened, I suppose, but not so much. I think it was the speed. They were having to get out fast from wherever they were. And then they'd stand somewhere else.
How long might you be in the line, as it were? in the fighting situation or pursuit situation?
Well, a fairly long time.
I was thinking in the sense of, you know, when did you get a rest? How long would you?
I suppose it's difficult to remember, but I suppose after a week or two, we'd be pulled up for something. And the main thing we, you know, was getting baths and things. But we would occupy places like this village for a week. And then we'd be off and you might go 10, 20 miles. And then we were relieved, I suppose. But, I mean, like in that village, nobody relieved us. We were there for... I was there for a week, and the battalion was there longer. And then Americans tended to take over as well.
Do you remember the Christmas 1944, which would be the last Christmas of the war?
I don't remember the Christmas very well, but I remember the New Year's Eve very well. Because, I mean, the Christmas, you know, there was lots of celebration sort of thing when you got the chance. But we came out the line for a week just after Christmas, and I remember us being attacked by planes, and there was this incredible thing, these low flying planes, and one came along and I could actually see the pilot. I could see his face. He was flying so low and so near, but I've never forgotten that. I could see the man's face clearly. And this was, I don't know, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, round about that time. And that's when I had a comedy thing with John Mogg. I don't know if I've told you about
it. You haven't told me.
Well, we were out the line for a week, you see, round about New Year. And, of course, you spent most of the time drinking in the mess. And he and I had arranged this thing, and no one else knew. And we're in the mess this night. We've all been drinking. And then he and I start a cod row, an argument, you see. Well, I'm a lieutenant, he's the colonel, you see. And he's 6'2" and I'm 5'6". And we start this row. And he's insulting me, and I'm telling him if he took his tunic off, I'd sort him out. The adjutant is... keeps getting hold of me and said, "Jim, what do you think you're doing?" I said, "You keep out of this. He's not talking to me like that." So he sent for two pairs of boxing gloves, John Mark, one of the waiters, and he came back with them. We put them on, took the jackets off. And this agent said, "Jim, for God's sake, stop it." And he's on again, John, he's saying, I said, "Come on, you won't last 2 minutes with me. I'll take you in no time." And we're sparring up, going round and round, and suddenly we came together and started waltzing. Well, the mess just fell about. Everybody collapsed laughing, you see. And so did John, so did I. But they really fell for it. They thought I'd really flipped. And when I met up with him after the war, at the reunion one year in Newcastle, he mentioned this when we were having dinner and drinks and that, and he'd moved all the current brigadiers and people away from the centre table and said, "You don't mind, gentlemen, do you?" Because by then he was deputy director of SHAFE, and he'd arrived resplendent in his fantastic uniform, and he said, "Hello, Jim, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm in the BBC, you know." "Good," I said, "you've done well, haven't you? I can tell from all the brass." He said, "Oh, not bad." And a brigadier came walking over to me as John moved away. He said, "How dare you? Do you realise you're talking to General Sir John Mark, second in command?" I said, "Well, didn't you even tell him he'd done well? I said he'd done well." Anyway, when we went into it, he moved the name tags. "You don't mind, gentlemen, do you?" And he said, "Right, Roy Griffiths, Roy, you sit there. Trevor, I think it was. Jim, you sit there. Somebody's got to make us laugh." And we sat round him, about five or six of us who'd been with him, and had a fantastic night and reminisced, you know, and drank. And the next day when he'd gone, I said to one of the lads, I said, he'd love that, because I said he was back when he was a soldier fighting, not some general sticking flags in maps. And I said people were actually shooting at him then, and I said he obviously loved every second of it, you know. Anyway, so that's I don't know how I got to that, was it?